This podcast is for general education, information, and entertainment purposes only, and is not to be used as medical advice for any particular patient. Clinicians must rely on their own informed clinical judgment in making recommendations to their patients. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policies or positions of any entity. Hello and welcome to the first ever episode of the BCR Pod. I'm Michael Fishman.
And I'm Jamie Lim. We are both senior residents in the BCRP and your hosts for this podcast.
We're going to be taking the next 15 minutes or so to review a few of the case-based residency conferences from the past week, a few tilts or things I learned today from our clinical shifts, and then highlight co-residents doing cool stuff and any big upcoming events.
Starting off with Monday's noon conference, which was Interpretation of LFTs by Dr. Christine Lee. The takeaways that I took away from this conference were, first of all, just to pay attention to your terminology. Don't call them LFTs unless they're actually reflective of liver function. So for example, these are things like your glucose level, albumin, as well as coags. And the other thing that I don't think she said directly during this conference, but that I've been told by GI doctors in the past, is to try to avoid using the term transaminitis because you cannot have an actual inflammation of enzymes. In the conference, Dr. Lee went through different patterns of liver enzyme abnormalities, kind of split them up into hepatocellular patterns, cholestatic patterns, and isolated hyperbilirubinemia patterns. Hepatocellular patterns present with more prominent AST and ALT elevations rather than GGTP and ALKFOS, whereas cholestatic patterns present with more isolated elevations in GGTP and ALKFOS, and then with isolated hyperbilirubinemia, as the name shows, you have more of an isolated increase in the bilirubin levels. The pearl from this conference was to really think about the anatomy of the liver and the pattern of LFT abnormalities to determine what's going on.
On Wednesday, we had a wonderful conference by our teach resident, Dr. Pamela Chen, giving a great case about this newborn who was found to have neurofibromatosis 1 in the setting of a congenital glaucoma, and then ultimately was discovered to have a very large intracranial mass that extended from the orbits to C2, C3. And one of the big things that I took away from this was putting yourself in the position of the resident when you get the call from radiology describing this large intracranial mass, and then thinking about what are the big contingency plans you need to be thinking about and how to manage them appropriately. And so she presented these three in wonderful buckets, thinking of herniation, stroke, and cord compression as big must not miss clinical implications that you should be looking out for, and then thinking about the clinical findings and the management of each. So from a herniation perspective, obviously looking at focal neuro changes, altered mental status, and of course, last case, Cushing's triad, bradycardia, hypertension, and abnormal breathing patterns. For this management, of course, orders neuroprotective measures, elevating the head of bed, making sure that the head is midline, normo everything, so normoglycemia, normonatremia, normothermia, can give hypertonic saline as needed, obviously letting neurosurgery know and controlling the airway as necessary as well. From a stroke standpoint, also looking for altered mental status, focal neurologic deficits, weakness, thinking about stat imaging, think about whether it's hemorrhagic or ischemic, getting a neuro consult. Just a reminder, in pediatrics, it tends to less likely be ischemic, so careful with anticoagulation as needed. And then from a cord compression standpoint, you're looking for sensation changes, weakness, and reflex changes. Typically, we think of upper motor neuron as hyperreflexia, but just remembering in the immediate period, they can be downed reflexes as well. And the management of this is stat steroids, stat neurosurgery, stat imaging, and stat intervention as needed.
Wednesday's noon conference was done by our very own Dr. Kate Michelson. The case was of a 16-year-old with a history of an adnexal cyst presenting with left lower quadrant pain found to have adnexal torsion. So the quick pearls that I took away from her conference was that first, the term adnexal torsion is a term that encompasses both ovarian and fallopian tube torsion. And then more importantly, I learned that ultrasound is a very specific, but only around 50% sensitive for adnexal torsion. The clinical signs that are actually quite sensitive for torsion include a known adnexal cyst of greater than 5 centimeters, as well as the concurrent onset of pain, nausea, and vomiting.
And then on Thursday, Dr. Lucas Gaffney gave a wonderful case of the week of a 17-month-old newly arrived immigrant with multiple GI upper respiratory infections and severe malnutrition. And some of the big takeaways that I took from this and from the previous health equity rounds that was done on this patient as well is that the AAP has an immigrant health toolkit. If you just Google that, you'll find all of their resources in terms of both supports, legal cares, and then also the initial workup to initiate for any of these patients. Malnutrition has three big buckets. So we're thinking about micronutrient related, undernutrition, and overnutrition. Other things just to think about, not directly linked to medical care, but that have huge impacts on these patients' overall health, is that MassHealth Limited only covers mostly emergent care. So being in constant communication with case management, thinking about the long-term needs of your patients. There's no citizenship requirement for WIC, and it does not fall under public charge, though many of the families that we take care of are still appropriately fearful of this. So having that discussion. The term failure to thrive is actually now transitioning to growth faltering. And if you want to learn more, you should check out the case report written by several of our wonderful co-residents in contemporary pediatrics.
And Friday, we had health equity rounds, and there's a special health equity rounds between the Department of Pediatrics and the Graykin Center's Addiction and Medicine Fellowship program, and presented by Drs. Kareem Khan, as well as Drs. Larissa Wenren, Alex Potorf, and myself. Our takeaways, first, the rates of stimulant use and overdose are rising, especially when they co-occur with opioids, and they're rising rapidly among people of all age groups, including adolescents and young adults. The war on drugs of the 70s and 80s was very racist and intentionally targeted Black communities by associating them with and then criminalizing crack cocaine. Whereas on the other hand, while the response has been far from ideal, the opioid epidemic has largely pushed forward the idea of addiction as a chronic disease that's best met with evidence-based therapies, harm reduction strategies, and has received substantial government funding. Thinking about these double standards, with the rising rates of cocaine and stimulant co-use with opioids, we must not repeat our racist past and make sure that we respond to the so-called fourth wave of the opioid epidemic with racial equity in mind. Moving on to our tilts of the week. For those of you that don't know, TILT, T-I-L-T stands for a thing I learned today, and is a hashtag that is taking the Twitter world by storm. Fish, do you want to get started with your tilts for the week?
Well, it was tough sorting between the 80,000 retweets that we had, but I'll pick one to start with. Something that I actually found really, really fascinating is I came across this new paper that had just come out, and it was talking about this study of a prospective propensity match cohort of almost 300 pediatric patients that found that IV magnesium actually led to increased rates of hospitalization and worsened asthma severity scores, which was fascinating to me because I always thought of IV magnesium as one of the wonderful medications in the ED to actually prevent admission. And being honest, when I'm on the inpatient side, if someone was being admitted for an asthma exacerbation and didn't get IV mag, I was a little bit upset because that seemed like the whole purpose of it. And it led me to do some digging based on where I initially kind of thought of that data. And I saw there was a Cochrane review in 2016 that did show an odds ratio of about 0.3 for decreased hospitalization, but the Cochrane review is based on a meta-analysis of only 115 pediatric patients, and they do mention that it's very low quality evidence. I don't know if you had heard anything about this like magnesium stuff, but it was very against what I'd always known.
Yeah, that's crazy. I was literally last night, we had a patient who came in on continuous albuterol, and I was telling my intern, oh, if they're not turning around, we can always consider redosing mag. Which I'm sure there's even less evidence for if the initial dose of mag is showing that that outcome is actually.
Yeah, I don't think this on its own is going to change my use of mag in the ED right now, but I do think the evidence is much less strong than I had previously thought, and we'll be definitely looking out for any further studies on this moving forward.
My first tilt for the day was, I learned about glycogen storage disease type zero, which I did not know was a thing. This type zero sort of, glycogen storage disease occurs because of the inability to synthesize as opposed to break down glycogen, from a deficiency in glycogen synthase. And so as a result, this is a glycogen storage disease that is actually not associated with hepatomegaly. Because again, unlike the other glycogen storage diseases, the problem isn't with breaking down glycogen, it's just with synthesizing it in the first place. This kind of came up on our differential for a patient that I was cross-covering over the weekend on Gen Peds, who just kept having hypoglycemia and then had postprandial hyperglycemia. It was just kind of weird that his blood glucose levels were so fluctuant and so kind of sensitive to what he was eating at the time.
That's pretty crazy. Glycogen store disease type 0 is usually on a lot of my differentials for patients.
Yeah, right. There's so many more glycogen storage diseases than I ever wanted to know about.
You know, I have so much respect for anyone who is interested or going into like metabolism and genetics, because it's just an absurd number of things that they have to keep apart.
Yeah, I agree. It's too much for this future PEMDOC's brain to handle.
Yeah. What is it? Hammer, nail, something?
Something about a hammer and a nail.
What is it, a type 0 or a type 1 nail? We'll figure it out. My next tilt was, I've been cross-covering in the MICU, and a lot of our patients have actually recently or in the past had trachs placed. And so I wanted to take some time to think about how to manage trach emergencies, because I think outside of the ICU, we generally don't have any exposure to this. And it's something that can happen at any time, and you might be the first person in the room. And so I found this really good framing of it, where you're thinking about the three different buckets of trach emergencies, and then they're all split based on the timing relative to placement. And so what that means is you think about them either as an early complication, so less than 7 to 14 days from placement, or late, after 7 to 14 days in placement. So kind of similar to how we think about G-tubes as well. But the three buckets are accidental decannulation, oops, it came out, obstruction, oh, it's stuck, and then bleeding, which is just blood coming out of it. So from an accidental decannulation standpoint, if it's in the early phase, you do not replace it. You call an airway code, get ORL there, you bag and you intubate. And the big concern is that you'll cause a false tract by replacing it too soon. From a late standpoint though, once the tract has matured, you can replace it. Consider downsizing if needed, and then you manage the airway as needed. From an obstruction complication standpoint, if it's early, just always make sure you have a backup airway plan. You can deflate the cuff and you can remove the inner cannula, pass a suction catheter. If you have it available, you can always pass a bronch as well to see what the obstruction is. And then you can always replace and use a smaller diameter if needed. From a bleeding standpoint, which I think is probably what I was most scared of, from an early standpoint, think surgical site, suction trauma, tracheitis, just inflate the cuff, apply some pressure. If you see some bleeding from like the surgical site or around, you can do some silver nitrate as well. The biggest, scariest thing is if there's bleeding from a late trach. So all the same things as above, but now the big thing you're worrying about is a tracheoanominate fistula. So you're looking for ET tube pulsations. This one, you overinflate the cuff to tamponade, remove the trach, intubate from above if you can, insert a finger into the stoma and pull anteriorly to occlude the artery. You should have called the code by now, please. And surgical management is necessary if this patient is hemorrhaging. And so just overall contingencies to think about, always have a backup airway plan in place, have a backup trach of the same size and one of a smaller size in the room. This is really helpful for me, is thinking about like what we hand off to each other, but know if the patient can be intubated or ventilated from above, and then know when the trach was placed.
A tracheoanominate fistula, I'm guessing that's when the trach fistulizes with the anominate artery.
Yes.
All right. Just have to really spell things out for me.
Bad bleeding. Blood coming out of a place you don't want it to.
So sorry, coming out fast. Could you review what bleeding is again? Just when blood comes out.
I think so.
Okay. And then my next tilt was that so for creatinine levels obtained using the Jaffe method as opposed to an enzymatic assay, hyperbilirubinemia may actually interfere and result in an artifactually low level. This came up because we had a liver patient that was transferred to us from the MICU to the ICP over the weekend, who was kind of chronically hyperbilirubinemic. There is a note about how you can't really trust the creatinine levels. When I looked into this a little bit further, it's only really relevant in if the lab is running certain types of assays. There's a type of assay called the Jaffe method or the Jaffe reaction, which I honestly can't explain further than that. And then I think that there's a more modern approach that people use called, which is an enzymatic assay. I'm honestly not sure which one Children's uses. I meant to call the lab and ask, which I'll try to do this week. Again, just being mindful that hyperbilirubinemia may kind of interfere with creatinine levels.
Actually, on that same patient, when they were in the NICU, I was there, they actually presented with an acute upper GI bleed. And this is a patient that actually had chronic cirrhosis as well. So something that we actually don't see in pediatrics very much, but it made me look into the management and the thought process of an acute upper GI bleed in pediatric cirrhosis.
And this patient had cirrhosis because of his genetic syndrome, right? It was Alagille syndrome.
Yeah. Which I think I've seen two patients now with Alagille syndrome, which is such a fascinating.
Yeah, I know. I don't think I've ever actually seen a patient with Alagille syndrome before him.
Yeah, but yeah, the liver complications, I think, were all secondary to the underlying genetic syndrome. And I think the biggest concern is upper GI bleed with cirrhosis is it's a variceal bleed until proven otherwise. So timely management is key. And so always, again, ABCs, monitors. We talk about dual large bore IVs, but it's so important to know what bore IVs you're getting and get that access early and then elevate the head of bed. Acid blockade, so thinking about your PPIs, your H2 blockers, infusion and BID have similar evidence. And then octreotide actually is shown to reduce portal hypertension. It increases the GI pH as well. So a bolus and then an infusion is often recommended by hepatology. Ceftriaxone, even if they have no fevers or infectious symptoms, ceftriaxone is given, it's prophylaxis for risk of bacteremia. There's actually some good evidence for mortality benefit in adults, rebleeding risk, and then risk of SBP and bacteremia afterwards. Obviously, talking to your GI colleagues about when the appropriate timing of a scope is, pending the hemodynamics, and then evaluate and aggressively correct any coagulopathy.
And moving on to our last section, resident highlights. So for this week, we wanted to highlight Tom Kuriakos and Sonia Tanasia, who published an article in Pediatrics that came out recently called The Weight of Our Words, How Medical Communication Perpetuates Bias. They published this article with, I don't know if you've heard of Bob Vinci.
Bobby V.
And it was a really, really powerful essay. We are very lucky to have one of the co-authors of the paper, Dr. Sonia Tanasia, with us over Zoom. Sonia, would you mind telling us a little bit about your paper?
Of course. So I, along with one of my UHAT co-residents, Tom Kuriakos, and with our esteemed, wonderful, amazing chair of pediatrics at BMC, Dr. Bob Vinci, put together a paper kind of inspired by this idea that the way we talk about patients is something that maybe we don't focus on enough as sort of a part of the cycle of how we can we actually create institutional bias, institutional racism, like in within like the like infrastructure of medicine. So essentially we kind of made this comparison between like how how sort of like medical care has really codified safety measures and like safety communication about like sort of patient presentations in medicine in order to make things safer for patients. So that, you know, when we sign out, we're signing out like the proper information about the patient, the proper treatment, the proper like contingency plans. But how, when we talk about patients in like more of an editorialized way, or like we talk about their social context, we allow sort of more, we allow our own biases and less objective information to sort of seep into that. And that can cause us to make decisions based on our biases and our sort of, our biases rather than sort of like objective information. And so that of course can include like racism, that can include like sort of bias against people who don't speak English as a first language, bias against kids who have developmental delays, like sort of almost everything. And it's so we wanted to kind of talk about how like when we editorialize about patients and kind of have our like common workroom chatter that can actually cause like true impacts for patients that can impact their care, their lifespan, their experience of the hospital, their relationship with the hospital system.
Yeah. That's like such an important thing to think about. I really like the analogy that you made to like medical misinformation being something that, or medical miscommunication being something that's like well studied and actually something that affects outcomes, and thought that the call to action to really like think about biased communication was really, really important. And then could you finally just comment on what it was like to work with Bob Vinci? Was he just extremely difficult to work with?
It was honestly awful. I mean, it was, I don't know how it could have been worse, to be honest. I've never felt so unguided. Obviously it was excellent. It was truly a joy. I think like it really made the whole process, I would say, from like just talking about this idea from like a noon conference that we both were talking about to like actually putting it into publication, the entire process was probably a year. And obviously just because we're all very busy and things like that, but in the communication of that year, like it was an extremely fun year because we not only could like talk about this in like an academic way and like discuss our thoughts about it, get feedback from Bob, but we also, you know, we throughout the entire process, we were all pranking each other and having a lot of fun and joking around, and he had us over to his house to sort of celebrate the paper when it was published. And he is just truly like a joy to work with. And it was so much fun.
Can you give us an example of a prank?
Oh, absolutely. So I think at some point there was let's say the last few months of our paper, like once it was actually written to actually publishing it, Tom and I decided to battle it out as to who is Bob's favorite resident, and it is definitely me. However, there was some confusion somehow in between in that process. But this all started with me and Bob at one of our Department of Pediatrics happy hours, thinking it would be really hilarious. Honestly, this was mostly Bob's idea. Really hilarious to send Tom a picture of me and Bob with like a sign that said, "Who's Tom?" Like, we don't know. Tom even contributed to this portal. And who is he? And so then we sent that to Tom, and then that just escalated into like a huge fight. When we were filming our video abstract for the paper, Bob was like about to sort of do one of his segments. This is a blooper reel we have where he was about to say, like, you know, "Sonia, we really have to think about bias in all these ways so that we could add it to our abstract." And instead he said that Tom was his favorite resident. Obviously that was a huge joke, but the actual blooper reel is quite funny. I'm happy to share that with anyone who would like to see it. But
oh yes, please. That would be awesome. The article can be found on the AAP's Pediatrics. There's an awesome video abstract, like Sonia just mentioned. Thanks so much for being on BCR Pod.
Thanks for having me, Jamie. This was so much fun.
Well, this has been another episode of BCR Pod. I'm Jamie Lim.
And this is Fish. Before sign off, any upcoming events you want to let our audience know about?
Yeah, we are going into our last week of February 2022.
Ooh.
Tuesday, we have the Great BCRP Bake Off Tasting. On Wednesday, we have the T-shirt design medal ceremony. I'm personally hoping that the
Bobby V's
design comes out as the winner. On Thursday, we have a BCRP writing retreat. On Friday, we have code names. On Saturday, there's Bollywood dancing and a Middlesex Fells hike. And then on Sunday, there's ice skating as well as virtual mixology with Tom Sandora.
Is the ice skating before or after the drinking event?
It looks like it's before.
Mm, good thought.
Yeah, safe. It's a safe way to do things. We want to thank Chris Cheston, our advisor, and our future sponsors, if you're out there. Our theme music is Sweet Disposition by The Temper Trap, covered by our very own Michael Fishman. And our incidental music is the four open notes of a ukulele played by yours truly.
Thanks for joining us, and we hope you'll tune in next week for our next episode of the BCR Pod. Thank you.